Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, episode 140, recorded February 24th, 2014. Daniel Suarez.
Triangulation is brought to you by Lynda.com. Learn what you want, when you want, with access to over 2,000 high-quality online courses and training videos, all for one low monthly price. To try it free for 7 days, visit lynda.com/triangulation. That's lynda.com/triangulation. And by Personal Capital. With Personal Capital, you'll finally have all your financial life in one place and get a clear view of everything you own. Best of all, it's free. To sign up, go to personalcapital.com/triangulation.
He rolled onto his back and stared up at a stretch of spotless blue sky. His usually methodical mind sped frantically through the possibilities, like someone groping for an exit in a smoke-filled building. He had to do something. Anything. But what?
But what?
Well, and therein lies a story. That is Jeff Gerner, and the voice of many, many great audiobooks, but in particular for me, the voice of Daniel Suarez's novels. Welcome to Triangulation, a very special triangulation. Daniel Suarez is back with a new book. Many say his best yet.
Wow.
It's called Influx. We're going to talk about that, but he's brought along a friend, Jeff Gerner, who reads all your books. Jeff, it's nice to see you.
It's really great to be here.
You don't sound the same when you're in person to me as I hear, boy, and
when I'm coming in stereo.
As soon as Influx starts, you go, yeah, I'm right back in the Daniel Suarez world because of Jeff Gerner's voice.
Good.
Yeah. So it's great. It's great to have you both. Welcome to Triangulation. Very excited.
Thanks for having us.
Everybody here loves Daniel's books. You probably read Damon. That was a segment from Damon, or Demon.
Yeah.
We talked about this last time. It's Demon you like.
Yeah, I say Demon.
Yeah.
And then, of course, a lot of Unix people say Damon. And, you know.
It's probably worth saying Damon because it's spelled D-A-E.
It
is. And
then
that way people, when they see it in the bookstore, say, oh, Damon.
I'll tell you why I did it initially, back before people knew who I was at all.
This is your first novel?
Yeah, the first novel was, and of course it was self-published back then, Demon. Had a chance of scooping up some of the occult people as well. I figured
this is not
let's
occult.
Not alienate any audiences here. That's all comers. So.
And then Freedom TM and Kill Decision. And you were here, I think, right when Kill Decision had come out about to come out.
Yeah, I believe so.
And I think you were already working on this next one. But of course, as any good novelist, you refuse to say a word about
it. That's right.
Wow.
Oh, cool.
Wow. Do you want to do the honors of summarizing? You probably got it down.
I have
now.
A pretty succinct summary.
How many Good Morning
I have like six different types. I was like, how many seconds do you need? No. It is the Influx is the story of a young physicist who invents a gravity mirror.
An anti-gravity device.
Well, yes. Yeah. But more than that, it can redirect gravity in any way. It can spread it out. And instead of winning the Nobel Prize, he's grabbed and imprisoned by an organization that is fearful of the social disruptions that massive innovations like that could cause. And so it's really a story about resistance to change and fear of the future, things like that.
Yeah. And the first thing, you know, as I'm reading it, I'm going, Daniel, I didn't know you were a physicist. Because the physics, I mean, I don't know, for all I know, it's all gobbledygook, is it?
No. See, this is the big thing. I try to replace that technobabble with some actual stuff, because I figure if, rather than just saying reverse the polarity, you might as well just fill that in with something real. And so I talked to a lot of physicists. I started, actually, by reading Lisa Randall's Warped Passages, which is a great book on string theory, in case anybody wants a book like that.
I'm looking it up.
But what the really interesting thing about that book is, I don't know how many times you've read books on string theory, and then you'll almost understand it for like 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And then it just goes away. It's like I had it, and then it was gone.
Yes.
Her book, I could actually see the bigger picture, and she's very good at relating it to things you do understand. So that helped me frame the questions I needed for the physicist I talked to at JPL. And Eric Bird, who's in the acknowledgments in the book, I pestered him for many hours. And as I pointed out in the acknowledgments, whatever crimes against physics remain in the book are my fault, not his. But what I wanted to do, since I think it's a little too steep to expect that I should actually invent anti-gravity to write a book on anti-gravity, I wanted to couch my hero's solution in a gray area of gravitation. So I wanted to find out where the edge of our knowledge was and kind of stuff it somewhere where it could conceivably occur.
It's plausible.
What's plausible. And I wanted a physicist to be able to read the book and enjoy it. And then, of course, everybody else can read through those sections, and they don't have to understand every single bit of it. But it's based in decent science.
Yeah, I mean, as I read it, I went, well, I don't know if Daniel's blowing smoke or if this is real, but it sounds real to me.
Yeah, I foolishly decided to have a brand early on where I had very authentic science.
Now you got to do
it. That's a lot of extra work, it turns out.
Now you got to do it. This book came out just 4 days ago.
Yeah.
But already I think the drumbeat is very strong. People are excited about it.
Yeah, we just got another good review from Wall Street Journal, and I don't know, I'm pinching myself, very happy.
It takes place, I guess all of your books are in the near future, kind of.
Yeah.
This could be the present.
This really is the present, maybe just a couple years in the future.
Yeah.
But that's, again, sort of my brand, that I tend to couch my stories or place my stories either in the now, or looking at real technologies that are either combined in new ways, or maybe just a little into the future.
Yeah.
But for instance, with Demon, a lot of the technologies in Demon have since come to pass.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Very close.
I've had it for a little while because I had the pre-release edition.
Oh, yeah, the galley.
Nice hardcover version. But I gave this to my daughter. She's 21. She's very interested in science. Loved it.
Cool.
Just flipped her lid. And she was particularly interested in the science of it and how realistic it seemed.
See, that makes me really happy.
Yeah.
If somebody, I get this occasionally, people will say, I have a Google window open when I'm reading your
books.
Yeah,
you pretty much, that would.
And typically it doesn't come up with, well, that's BS. It comes up with real stuff and then they start to follow it. And that excites me. I like that.
She gave me some questions for you.
Let's have
it. I love it. She wanted to know how you turn current scientific facts into your personal fictional creations. How do you go, and I guess you almost kind of talked a little bit about that, how do you go from what we know now to what could we know?
Well, I think one of the chief things that I do is I will combine current technologies in unexpected ways. And I think that's a lot how innovation really occurs in real life. If you think about it, we had the internet and then we had cell phones, but when they really combined and you started to have the smartphone, suddenly just everything took off and it radically changed things. So notice that you had both around for a little while and it took just one spark to send it in a different direction. I will try to combine things like that.
So now, like Thomas Kincaid's a painter of light, you're a painter of ideas.
Oh, I like that. that's exactly what I meant.
Yes, I am. Exactly.
I'm a painter of ideas. That's great.
She was also interested in the politics of it. Your first two books, Damon and Freedom TM, are really apolitical.
Yeah.
Although, well, I guess
as evidenced by the fact that I get people who are fans of the books from both sides of the political spectrum.
There's a utopian element to
it. There is.
Kill Decision, much more political. And,
yes.
And she wanted to know, and she says, and we're not going to, we want to be very careful about spoiler alerts here. She was very interested. Is there a specific message about the abuse of power or politics? Because in this book, I think it's safe to say the government sits on technological advances.
Yes. Yeah, that wouldn't be a spoiler.
That's not a spoiler.
Although I would describe it this way, that what I caution against is any unaccountable concentration of power.
Perfect.
And I don't care whether that's the government,
perfect,
a corporation, the church, a really badass Girl Scouts troop.
You
whatever
will
it is. That's
eat
right.
More s'mores.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Those Samoas are pretty good. I guess.
See, they got their hooks in you. But, that's my point.
Let me ask Jeff a couple of questions because he's sitting there and I don't want him to feel like a third wheel here. Now, there's a lot of science in here. Difficult to read?
Yeah, well, certainly I have to go through the pronunciations.
I'll tell you why I say that, because I read a little bit of this out loud just to see.
Yes.
And
were you injured?
Yes, my tongue is still sore.
Lost a tooth. A
lot of big words in there, but you do it quite fluidly. And
well, I was fortunate enough to get on the phone with Dan and ask him what.
Is that your process generally with an author? Because you read a lot of thrillers.
It not always. I mean, I have been fortunate enough to get to know a few of the authors whose works I've narrated. But I think when I started with Demon, it was just the producer, I think, going back and forth. Yep, but yep. It's always that. Particularly.
So when you did the Axel the Truck series. Did you talk to J.D. Reilly?
I needed to know how to say vroom. No, Kevin Thompson is the guy who's done all the direction and producing.
Producers are so important in this.
He's great. Kevin's great. Whip smart and really creative and comes from an acting background himself. But he was great about, and always is, about finding, pronouncing. Because he reads the book, too, and he finds out what he needs to know.
Yeah.
But this time I got on the phone with you and on...
I had to laugh about this one because occasionally I think Jeff must be like, you bastard, you, I swear you put these words in here.
What is hibernity? Hibernity?
Yeah. Hibernity? Hibernity.
How do you pronounce that?
Then you have chemicals that have seemingly no vowels in them, and they go on for
easy to type, hard to read.
Yes, yes. But he does a great job because I've listened, for instance, to a big section in Influx where you do it flawlessly.
Yeah.
I was like, sorry, Jeff.
It was all on the first take.
Oh, I try to find errors. I do. And it's not, I'm surprised, really, at the number of audiobooks that have mispronunciations or errors like that. But Jeff's always really good. So I don't know whether to credit your producer or you, but...
Both. We'll both take it.
Yeah. We're going to actually do something. I think we're going to do a reading. Is that right? Do you want to do that?
Sure.
I think I saw you tweet something like that.
I would love that. Let me just say real quick, though... I have to admit that I was hesitant to listen to an audiobook for the first time.
Yeah.
And I don't know if other writers can relate to this. And by the way, it turned out wonderfully because I love the way you do my books.
Thanks.
But when you write a book, there is a voice in your head.
You hear it, yeah.
And I thought, that's going to mess with that. Like, if I go down to write another book, am I going to hear Jeff's voice, not my voice? And as it turns out, you don't.
Well, it was cool this time, too, because the fact that we were able to touch base before I went to record.
Yeah.
I actually shot not just how do you pronounce this and what the hell does this mean, but character stylings. I mean, we talked about voices and things like that.
Voices and so forth.
And you do such a great job. It's almost schizophrenic in the way that you can just be all these different people literally within seconds of each other.
We did play, and I'm going to play a little bit more. We played some Damon, the very first book.
The phrase.
A little bit of Jeff.
What the hell just happened?
Russian spurting
between his fingers.
In memory.
Adrenaline surged through his system, his heart beating faster.
This is a good book, too, for a reader because... it's very exciting, and there are scenes of like this is the first scene in the novel, but then there's the scene in the shootout in the house where it's very amped up, and I'm sure part of the temptation is to your voice to go up three octaves, and then he came out of the door, and you can't do that. You'd have to let the listener get
do it.
Right.
I mean, you want to be. You want it to be organic. You want to be involved in it yourself, but you do have to keep in mind that you're.
It's like acting of any kind.
Absolutely. It's the same thing. You let them... You're taking the journey yourself, not to sound too esoteric about it, but you have to remember that, there's still an audience, and you got to make sure that there are technical things you want to address with the way you use your voice.
I would say it's like a one-man show, except you're playing literally multiple characters next to each other. Yeah.
Yeah. When you so that's interesting that I didn't realize that you might talk to Daniel about a character and say, well, what does he sound like? What is he... What's his psychology? That kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, we did on this time around in particular with Hedrick and Cotton, is that his name? Yeah, Cotton, just sort of discussing a little bit of their history and where they might be and how their voice.
And you read on Cotton, I thought it was good because I was thinking of him the way he wanted to do him. So
that's great.
It's a good working relationship. The other thing that I think is funny. When I have neologisms, words that don't exist, and we sit down and we just decide what those sound like.
Yeah,
half
the
time
the answer
is
like hibernity.
I have no idea because I hadn't thought about that, and now you have to say it.
The answer was,
I don't know.
I don't know, man. Tell me.
Jeff, this is my policy in technology because I'm often the only guy who's ever pronounced a word in technology aloud except the people who invented the word as I get to say.
Yeah.
I can say if it's Jiff or Jiff.
Oh, that's interesting.
There you go.
Because I'm the first one who's going to say it, so I get to choose.
Wow.
You have a higher power to deal with.
He'll convince me usually, but we disagree.
We did have it funny. I think it was the last triangulation. We had an author on, Brett Martin, who did a nonfiction book and didn't like the reading. He said, I got in the car and my friend was listening to my book. And I said, what? This sounds familiar. Oh, my God. And the reason he didn't like it was interesting is the character choices It was about The Sopranos, and the reader had chosen a voice for David Chase. And of course, Brett knows David Chase. He said,
It's going to ruin it.
And it ruined it. And I had to tell him, God, I love the narration, but I don't know what David Chase really sounds like. Right. It brought it to life. That's always a challenge too with reading. And you know, you listen to people like Jim Dale, his interpretation of Harry Potter, and then you listen to Stephen Fry do the British version of Harry Potter. Dale does very unique voices for each person. In fact, I'm told he has a recorder that he'll record a sample of that character and listen back to it right before he reads that part to make sure it matches. Yeah. Stephen Fry, it's the least bit, you know, acknowledgement that this is another person.
Yeah. So it's like he's reading a bedtime story.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I'm wondering, you'd certainly do voices, but it's a fine line, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I think in the industry, you know, there are narrators who do both. To me, particularly with a book like this or Demon, you know, where you have the one scene where you've got the FBI and DARPA and CIA and NSA all sitting around a table, and they're all military men in their 50s and 60s.
Yeah, they can't all sound the same.
They've got to be distinguished somehow, but
I get to put labels on them.
Yeah, right. I prefer to, I mean, obviously, if it's a Russian character, you're going to have a Russian accent, but I prefer to find, you know, as much of an original bent for them as possible, as opposed to just narrating them. You know, I think Jim Dale's extraordinary at it, and it depends on the book too. With the Terry Francona book, I wasn't trying to do a Terry Francona voice. It
right.
would just be silly.
Right.
I just recently narrated Eric Prince's book. It's the founder of Blackwater.
Ah.
And again, it wasn't about doing an Eric Prince voice.
Yeah,
so when it's biographical, or autobiographical in that case, you know, it's more about just conveying the story, even when it does switch in between.
Right.
Fiction, then you can, you know, pull out all the stops and really be an actor.
Is your training a stage actor, or?
Yeah. I studied, you know, classically trained, and then spent most of my early career in the theater. I have kids now, so I don't get to leave town and do regional stuff and all
this
that anymore.
This is great, because you can do this for a living,
it's
right?
It's the best.
It's a full-time job for you.
Well, it is. I mean, among other things, I largely find myself doing voiceover work.
Ads and stuff like that.
Yeah, a lot of commercials.
Do you do video
and
games as well?
A lot of video games video I've games? Done and all that.
What video games have you done?
Oh, wow.
Anything
everything
recent?
From, what's the most recent one I've done? I did one of the Grand Theft Auto titles, not this most recent one that came out, 4. But just prior to that. After GTA 4, they had I was in 4 in San Andreas.
Were you the hooker,
and then there was,
the pimp? What,
done them all.
He's very funny.
Cop to, in, the most recent one was, a spin-off of, I guess, of GTA 4. And it was The Ballad of Gay Tony, it was called.
That's
a great
GTA
game.
GTA 4.
Well, and that was great because I got to...
Daniel knows, by the way. Oh,
nice. He's a gamer. Yeah, exactly. We spent a lot of time in game. Yeah. But in that one,
hours, that's all.
I got to play this character named Maury Kibitz, who... in this one, we actually... You know, now, in the old days, it was all animated, so you didn't get to do as much of the mocap stuff. You'd just go add the voice afterwards.
Right.
But on Ballad of Gay Tony, it was...
you actually
put on the mocap suit. Went
oh,
into the studio great. And acted out scenes with the other actors.
Do they record audio as you're doing the motion?
Most of it. You did have to go in and do some in post, but it was cool. You had to, you know, pre-shooting, you'd stand on this little turntable that goes around, and they capture you, taking photos from all angles, going in 360 degrees.
Because they're really wanting the lip motion, the facial expressions.
This is what's, or at least it was new to the industry when we did that. They've now attached... It used to be they would put the little reflective dots all over your face, and you'd do that after you did the physical work. Now they've got a camera that attaches to the helmet that looks right back at you.
Yeah.
So you're acting out the scene with the other actor.
Performance capture, essentially.
Performance capture.
I mean, it really is.
And that's what they use, of course, in Lord of the Rings and in Planet of the Apes.
Right.
A really amazing ability.
That's incredible. And then they can turn you into whatever. I mean, I was a bodybuilder character, and I had hair. It was great. But it's a fun game.
And I am told by a fan that you also are in Max Payne.
Yeah, Max Payne was my very first video game.
Wow.
That was great.
Are you Max?
No. I play...
Because he talks a lot.
The character's name?
A lot of inner dialogue.
Yeah, ton of him. God, I can't think...
It's been a
while. For the life of me, what was the name of the character, but it was great because... that was strictly in the booth. That was
great,
just VO work.
And that was.
This guy was a lunatic. He was a... I want to say his name was Loki. I forget
what
they
it's
him.
Always better to play the bad guy, isn't it?
He was a bad guy, and he ran this...
Yeah, a lot more
ran
fun.
This,
chew the scenery a little bit, and it's okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And it was fun. My little brother... called me on the phone and said, I got Max Payne. I just played it. I just killed you. Then I went back and I killed you every way you could possibly kill you.
Every way you could be killed, I've killed you now.
He was getting back at me for, our youthful beatdowns, but that was a fun one.
This is awesome. We're talking to Daniel Suarez, the author of course, so many great books that we love. Damon, nice. Freedom TM, Kill Decision. His new one just came out. And if you've read any of his books, you're going to want to read this. I think everybody who reads Demon just says, okay, I'm reading every one of Daniel's books from now. I think that's absolutely true.
I've been very kind to me.
I am going to read every one of his books because I love this guy. But if you haven't ever read a Daniel Suarez book, now here's the challenge. Demon's a great book, and but you have to read it and Freedom TM. I'm going to say start with Influx.
Oh, interesting.
I am going to say start with... I think this is a really good example of an author at his peak.
Oh, cool.
Maybe not peak. You're still going up.
That's it.
We won't
take
say
that.
Peak because that implies,
that's
you know.
Right.
Yeah, but no, you really hit your stride. Cool. This is so good.
I'm so glad to hear that, Leo.
So good. We're going to take a break. We want to hear Jeff Gurner, who's also with us. He's the voice of Daniel's novels, along with a lot of
books.
How many books have you done, do you know? I mean, I'm looking at Audible.
And I think I've probably done 40 or 50 titles,
which
is small compared to, you know, there's hundreds, thousands of titles.
Yeah. Anyway, we're glad to have Jeff Gurner along as well, and maybe we'll do a little reading. Do you know what part of this he's going to read?
Oh, yeah, I do.
You've already selected.
We've
or have you memorized it, Jeff?
Okay. That's right.
Got into audiobooks.
He's committed the entire book to memory. It's quite impressive, really. He does it on all of them.
We're going to bring you a special microphone because we want to give you the quality. And while we do that, let me talk a little bit about our sponsor, Lynda.com. I don't think Lynda yet has courses on how to read audiobooks, but they have courses on how to produce audio. They have courses on how to make video, and of course, how to use all the software, all the computer programs, all the operating systems you might ever run into. If you want to learn photography, audio, video editing, software, even soft business skills like negotiation, resume building, Lynda.com is the place for you. Over 2,000 courses, new courses all the time. In fact, this week they added, here's the courses, some of the courses, not all of them. They added this week, building an online community. I got to take that. That's great. Pro Tools mixing and mastering. I know, Jeff, you use Pro Tools. Yeah. The art of Photoshop compositing. Maya tips and tricks. UX design techniques. In fact, a particular design technique called ideation. That's pretty granular. Excel 2013 macros in depth. So you could get high-level stuff like how to use Excel to the very most fundamental stuff, pivot tables or macros in depth. And the beauty part is every one of these courses has a text transcription you can search so you can jump right to the part you want. Of course, you can watch the whole class beginning to end. Always very well produced with the best instructors. One of the reasons I love doing Lynda ads is because I know many of their teachers. They're some of my best friends, photographers, Photoshop wizards, people like Bert Monroy. It is just a great resource for you. Normally, you get access to the entire library for $25 a month or the premium subscription, which is $37.50 a month. We're going to give you a full free access to it for 7 days. You get a week to browse this 2,000 courses. Take any course you want. If you're just getting started with Windows 8, they've got great Windows 8 courses. There's the Mavericks course, the Photoshop Fundamentals course. It's great. Lynda, LYNDA.com. To get the 7-day trial, visit the special page at lynda.com/triangulation. LYNDA, not LI, LY.com/triangulation. And we thank Lynda Wyman, her great team, and the entire lynda.com community for their support of triangulation. Our guest, Daniel Suarez, the new book, Influx. It's available in hardcover. Yep. It is probably Kindle, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And, of course, my preferred version, Audible.com. Yeah. It's already... because I had the physical book, I actually read this one.
Oh, cool.
Man, my eyes are tired. I don't read anymore, you know?
Yeah.
It's so much easier to listen, and I apologize, because I'm sure... Do you care as an author?
No, that's the thing. I think we live in an age where it's... The word is content, and how you receive it, it's polymorphic.
Yeah.
So, as long as people get my book somehow, experience it somehow, how could I be upset about that?
Absolutely,
that would be great.
Sometimes people tell me I use the word "read" for audiobooks, and they say, "Oh, you're not reading." Well, I'm getting every word Daniel wrote.
Yeah.
It's coming into my sensorium, whether it comes through my eyes or my ears, it's still
it's
in my brain.
It's a colloquialism, right? You're receiving it.
I'm receiving it.
Yeah.
So let's see. From now on, I'm going to receive your book.
Receive.
Wow, that sounds really self-important.
From on high, I am receiving the books. So do you want to set up the segment, the section?
Hey, I have to ask you, do you ever warm up by saying words like falafel or...
Whatever I can. Just all right. It,
red just leather, hilarious. Yellow falafel, leather. Falafel, falafel, red falafel. Leather, right. Yellow leather.
There we go.
Red do you, Jeff? Actually, that's a good question.
What's that?
No, all right. Forget. Just ignore me. I'm just here. Do you... no, do you... You must do some sort of vocal...
You know, I mean, it's different. If I'm doing a musical and it's 8 shows a week, I mean, there's a warm-up process.
Oh, you're a singer too, huh?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I spent most of my early years in my career in musical theater.
How fun.
Worked on Broadway and off-Broadway and regional
musicals.
Theater.
Oh, I love it.
I do, too. I do, too. It's good fun. It's a lot of work.
I bet it is. But for you have to move and sing and act.
Yeah, and so eight shows a week
well.
Is rough.
Yeah. Wow,
yeah.
Good for you.
Yeah. So tell me about some of the shows you've done. What was your favorite role?
I did Lion King on Broadway for a long time. That was a good time.
Which character were you?
I was Ed the Hyena.
And by the way, if you've not seen Lion King, I think it's still playing.
It is.
It is a wonderful show. And Julie Taymor did those beautiful... puppets.
Yeah.
Did the hyena have
the hyena costume was interesting because it was a you had this harness that went over your shoulders around your waist, and then the hyena's head
that's right I remember
stuck
that.
Out of
yeah.
it and it had a puppet mouth, so one hand would go into the mouth to operate the mouth and the tongue and all of that. Then you had these two long hyena forelegs that you'd hold that had bicycle grips on them, braking grips that would articulate the toes of the
hyena. Meanwhile, and while you're doing that, can you tap dance and sing?
Exactly, run
and
up
then
and
do
down
a performance.
Stairs and down. And you spent the whole show bent over as well.
Oh,
as
oh,
and then when
Lord.
You had to use the puppet, both arms would go into one hand and then your right hand into the mouth to move the mouth. It was incredible. I mean,
it's a beautiful,
she's a genius.
Beautiful production.
It really is. It's
and
extraordinary
when
to see.
When the performers come down the aisles of the theater.
Yeah.
I mean, if you've not ever seen, I brought my kids to see it.
Front left leg of the elephant was also.
Oh, you
the hyenas are the elephant.
Is that in your credits now? That
no.
Hyena and front
slash
left leg.
Front left leg of elephant.
Weird times we're living in. I'm a bigger fan of the left leg. What was it, right leg?
Yeah, they played the which leg did you there? All right. So, do we want to set up this section of the book at all, or what do we need to know?
Yeah, do you want to describe it? Shall I describe it?
Well, I think you'll... why don't you set it up?
Sure, okay.
You know where
so,
we are, right?
We wanted to choose a scene that wasn't
it's
really
easy
a spoiler.
To spoil this
yeah.
book.
So
yeah.
This occurs early in the story when the character, the physicist John Grady, learns of the existence of the BTC from Graham Hedrick, the director of the BTC. And he has been brought to speed on the current technological development of humanity in reality. And so there's another character named Alexa who is trying to convince
him. We should say the BTC is the government organization.
Yes, the Federal Bureau of Technology Control, which was founded in the Cold War to try to prevent society from being disrupted by rapid technological innovations at the time. They were going through all the moon landings.
Scary, yeah.
And they got a little carried away, and they started harvesting all of this technology and then used it to accomplish their mission. So they are living basically 50 to 70 years more advanced than we are.
Right.
So John Grady, the physicist, has learned this, and they are trying to convince him to join their organization. And they have just presented to him a scenario, a computer model of what would happen if his invention were unleashed on the world. And it resulted in very dire consequences within a century. For all of humanity. So I believe that's where we're starting.
Yeah, right? he's just seen the model, and we'll take
Jeff
it from
Kerner,
there.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Okay, I get it. But I think you're painting a worst-case scenario. He sighed wearily and looked to Hedrick. I guess I hadn't thought through the consequences of my work, but I still say you're being pessimistic. Alexa folded her arms. These models have successfully predicted much more than this. Grady considered this. All right, okay. Hedrick smiled warmly. Then you'll join us. Grady pondered it and finally nodded again. Yes, I guess I am interested to see what other advances might speed my research along. Mr. Grady is lying. The voice came from the ceiling somewhere. It was the same disembodied voice that Alexa had spoken to. Hedrick looked disappointed. Thank you, Varuna. Alexa looked unsurprised. Hedrick focused a less friendly gaze on Grady. John, did you really think you could deceive us? There is no lying to the BTC. Grady looked at the walls and ceiling. Is that really an AI talking?
It's our bureau interface, and never mind what it is. I'm concerned that Varuna says you're being untruthful. Grady spoke to the ceiling and Hedrick both.
I'm not lying. Look, I want to have a chance to continue my work.
He gestured to the projection of the Earth.
It's obvious that I haven't the analytical power to assess the effects of gravity modification on society.
Mr. Grady, you are dissembling. Near-infrared readings of the activity in your occipital and frontal lobes demonstrate deceit-related latency.
Alexa, Hedrick, and Morrison stared at him.
He shook his head. This Varuna thing is wrong.
Alexa scowled.
Bigotry isn't appreciated here, Mr. Grady. In plain language, Mr. Grady, it takes humans longer to deceive than to tell the truth. When responding to external stimuli, humans require an average of 800 milliseconds to reach what's termed readiness potential, meaning a decision. Approximately 0.05 seconds later, a second surge of electrical activity implements that decision. Throughout your visit today, your brain required an average of 606 milliseconds to reach readiness potential. Your recent statements required almost twice that interval.
Hedrick pointed to the ceiling. We are primitive things, John. Our biological systems are well understood. Finally, Grady took a deep breath.
All right. Okay, you win.
He looked to Alexa.
Spare me the sermon about how I'm egotistical. The BTC controls advanced technology. You're putting yourselves in a position to technologically dominate humanity. That's what this is about, and I don't want any part of it. I'd rather burn my research than work for you.
Alexa turned to Hedrick and Morrison. Hedrick nodded to her. Thank you, Alexa. I appreciate you trying. She gave Grady one last look.
I consider it a personal failing that I was unable to convince you, because unlike you, I wasn't lying. Those simulations have accurately predicted the spread of the Internet, free markets, drug-resistant bacteria, and much more you don't know about.
Alexa started to walk away.
Sooner or later, you're going to realize we're right, Mr. Grady. For everyone's sake, I hope it's sooner.
In a moment, she slipped out through a side door, leaving Grady alone with Morrison and Hedrick. The men regarded one another. Hedrick shook his head sadly.
We have indeed seen your type before, John. The idealist. You call us megalomaniacal, and yet you're the one not cooperating with others. As for burning your work, we already have it. All of it. And I think you'll find that the BTC has many smart people who can start where you left off. It'll just take us a little longer without your particular mode of thought.
What you're doing is criminal.
I know you believe that. You feel violated. But ask yourself whether it's not your wounded pride that's made you dislike us. With time, perhaps you'll come to realize that the BTC is humanity's greatest hope for an enduring future, and that we as individuals have no right to alter society to suit our personal visions.
You're the one with a personal vision of society, not me.
It's not personal at all. We've been given a legal mandate to protect society. National Security Council memorandums of 1948 and number 68 of 1950 empower us to deceive the public for the greater good, what's known as the necessary lie.
Hedrick pressed his thumbprint to a digital document that had materialized on the tabletop in front of him.
And it's for the greater good that I'm remanding you to our Hibernity facility.
Hibernity? What is that?
A safe place for brilliant people who nonetheless failed to see reason.
You mean a prison?
Hedrick pursed his lips.
I suppose it is a prison, a humane prison designed to protect the public from dangerous ideas.
Morrison let a crooked smile spread across his face.
I'll take it from here, Mr. Hedrick.
Thank you, Mr. Morrison. Doors behind and to either side opened, and Grady turned to see a dozen swarthy, young, perfectly fit men enter in gray uniforms with inscrutable insignia at their shoulders. The men were identical in every way, with blonde crew cuts, square jaws, thick necks, and broad shoulders, though not particularly handsome. They looked, in fact, exactly like a younger version of Mr. Morrison. The realization dawned on Grady as the men approached calmly. Oh, my God. Morrison chuckled. You'll be seeing a lot more of me in the future, Mr. Grady. But then, so will everyone.
Yeah, Jeff Garner. That is something to watch. And I have to say, it's a great shame that people don't get to watch him work, but only get to hear.
It actually adds to
it. It's a great performance, and the chat room was going wild. And I love Varuna especially. God, that's a great character. Yeah,
and this is what we had long talk about her because she was named for an Indian goddess.
That's right.
So you gave her.
So we gave her
Indian.
A British, but with just a an Indian accent of someone who was educated in the UK,
and it works perfectly.
Yeah, yeah,
it really does.
Oh wow,
good time.
That is so much. I think Audible just sold quite a few copies of Influx.
Good.
Thanks to that. That is, of course, Daniel Suarez's newest book. Influx. Daniel is here. Jeff Garner, who reads his books and many others, but boy, you can see why how wonderful that is.
Yeah.
And I think people who say, "Oh, I couldn't listen to a book," there is such a qualitative difference because it comes alive for you. You mean it, and it, with a good reader like Jeff, it is a performance.
Well, that's
the key. Real characters just come through there, and I can see your reluctance because he's going to interpret. It's like going to see a movie, and I know we will see movies soon of. At least one or two of your books, but it's like going to see a movie. I'm sure, That's not that guy.
Well, my fear is I would start listening to my audiobook and it'd be like Bobcat Goldthwait.
Yeah, doing it. Oh, my God, want that.
But it wasn't that at all.
Not at all. Yeah.
Next time.
Hopefully not.
Wow, that was really good. We're going to take a little break, come back with some more. This is Triangulation. Daniel Suarez is here. During the break, if you'd like to run to audible.com, you can get your copy of Influx. Right. I don't know why Audible doesn't have an ad on this show. I guess because they don't need one. That is just fantastic. Have you ever won an Audi award?
I have. I've been nominated a couple times. I haven't won one yet. A couple
soon.
Of the Golden Earphones Awards that Audiophile magazine gives
just out. Phenomenal.
Oh, thank
phenomenal
you.
Phenomenal stuff. Our show today brought to you by Personal Capital. This is actually another Triangulation guest we had on a little more than a year ago, Bill Harris. He was the CEO of PayPal and Intuit. And he, at the time, was talking about the idea of creating a site where you could put all your financial information, you could see it on a single page in a graphical fashion that really informed you about, you know, where your money was, what it was doing, whether it was working for you or not, how much you were paying in fees. Personal Capital was born. I joined it almost immediately, and I've been a very happy customer of Personal Capital. There, as your financial life, you know, grows, as you go through life, it gets more and more complicated. You've got credit cards, mortgages, loans. You've got checking accounts and savings accounts, each on a different website, different usernames. Very hard to keep track of, different passwords. And then, of course, if you're paying somebody to manage your money, how do you know you're not paying too much? Personal Capital puts everything on a single screen, not just on your computer, but they have a beautiful tablet and phone applications, Android and iOS. Real-time graphs, very intuitive, easy to understand. Yeah, you can also see how much you're paying in fees, whether you're overpaying, how you can reduce them. You can get tailored investment advice based on your information. This is a great program. And here's the best part. This is free. This is absolutely free. PersonalCapital.com/triangulation. It's a smart way to grow your money. Try it. I've been very happy with it. PersonalCapital.com/triangulation. We thank them for their support of Triangulation. More questions for Daniel Suarez from my daughter.
Oh, okay.
She had a lot of questions for you.
Yes.
She read the book. Do you mind when I say she read the book in like one day?
No, I think that's awesome.
She was like, put it down. She was up all night.
If it's a year later and they're trying to finish it, that's disappointing. Because it's a thriller. It's kind of hard
it's a
to
page
maintain
turner.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a page turner. And this actually could apply a little bit to Jeff and what we just heard, because she says, especially in science fiction writing, how do you deal with questions of race and class and gender? We've talked, I think, last time about how you write for women, and you write women mm-hmm. characters very well, I think.
Yeah, I try.
Yeah.
I think partially what helps is I had four older sisters, and I don't think I would have made it to adulthood if I didn't have a really
it's the same
view.
Thing for Jeff, too, though. I mean, you don't want to make these people caricatures.
No, no.
You want them
no.
characters, but not caricatures.
To me, I want them to be people.
People.
And the thing is, I look at the way the future is going. I think it's just, hopefully, a non-issue at some point.
I hope so, too.
Very often, what I'll do, and I've done this in the past, is I will literally take a random number. I'll basically create a database table with thousands and thousands of names in it and keep coming up with a name until I like it.
Oh, that's
and then whatever nationality that is.
Oh, that's interesting.
And then, you know, I just want it to be a nice, pleasant mix.
That's
basically.
How life is, right?
Yes.
It's not predictable.
Yeah.
The mathematician isn't always Chinese, right?
Yeah. And so that's what a database guy would do to choose characters. I have
you're a database
literally
guy.
Hundreds of thousands of names in a database, and that's how I just keep hitting it until something appeals.
We talked about this last time, but you were a software designer, a systems consultant, a database guy
before
you became a novelist.
For 17 years.
Yeah.
And it helps my work. It actually does. The other thing is, of course, physics. You know, I did a lot of research for physics for this book, but...
Right.
I've always had an interest in science.
Yeah.
You know, Cosmos, Carl Sagan, when I was a kid, that's what I would read. Yeah. Candle in the Darkness, another great book that he wrote.
And then, I don't think this is a spoiler, but she was very interested in how synesthesia is important in this book.
Okay.
And she's wondering where that came from.
I was trying to find for this character, I wanted to have a person who looked at the world differently.
Mm.
And that was having read a lot about genius, how it is, it's almost like an added dimension that you're perceiving. And so this is why my search history is so strange on my computer. Because I'll go from plastic explosives to synesthesia. I'm probably on every
boom,
list
boom,
there
boom.
Is.
Right? Yeah, no
but
kidding.
What I was looking for was a neurological disorder that is, it's sort of a form of autism in a way. And I pretty quickly settled on synesthesia, which is a cross-wiring in the brain.
You see numbers as colors
or you taste music.
Right.
And so what happens is you're perceiving things with more of your brain.
Mm-hmm.
So you have more processing power. And there are a great many synesthesiacs who are very gifted in music and art and math. And so, of course, that immediately intrigued me. And I thought, this is what I need to have this character when he looks up at the night sky. He sees the natural laws of the universe in color. He looks at mathematical equations, and he hears them, and if they are cacophonous, he knows there's something wrong with them.
Yeah. Isn't that great? I love that.
Yeah, it's really cool.
I imagine that's true, and maybe that's just because you're such a good writer that it feels true, but I imagine that Einstein must have had something like that going on.
He may have, and I know there's another aspect of the book that talks specifically about Einstein's brain and its structure and how it was different. So this is one of the great things about writing these books is I get to do research on subjects like this, and it's my work.
Is that a common thread in all of your... I guess it is.
It is because I'm fascinated by it, but also because I think technology and science, that's really where our future is. That's what's the great differentiator for us right now. And knowledge of technology, that to me is the new literacy, in the same way that just being able to read in the past. I think people need to understand how technology works at some degree in order to be a citizen of the modern world, to be able to have meaningful input.
Yeah. What, I love how you were able to take a book basically in the present day and also have 30 years in the future. That was very clever.
Yeah, it turned out to be really handy.
Yeah.
Fusion, not a problem.
No,
you can do that.
It's the future.
Yeah.
But it's here. Yeah. What do you think it'll be like 20, 30, 50 years from now?
See, that's the dangerous prediction business. I've been fortunate to get some of that right, although I always tell people, and you've probably read this before, that that's not really the purpose of science fiction prediction. It's basically a mirror we're holding to the present. And, of course, that's true here. You know, I'm really saying things about the present, the world. Now, where are we going to be in 20 or 30 years? I think nation states will be less important, and I think technology will be a great equalizer. It's spreading more and more rapidly. And I think that hopefully that means a lot of ideals that we have settled upon in the last couple hundred years, civil society and human rights, will spread. That's what I'm hoping.
You're an optimist. Yeah.
I am an optimist, but I'm an optimist in the sense that it's going to take everybody debating, working hard, arguing with each other. That, to me, is the future of society. Societies where everybody ostensibly agrees about everything worry the hell out of me. Because somebody's not telling the truth. So what I'm hoping is that we use all of this technology to basically have an honest civil society and exchange information, that information and knowledge be very portable,
and can cross borders, and that we start to think of ourselves more as a planet.
Do you try to avoid polemic and preaching in your books?
I do, and typically what will happen is I'll write two books, and then I'll take a machete to
that. Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So it comes out.
Yeah, there's probably a bit more polemics in it than I originally need, and then I'll sand off the edges. Because I don't want to hit anybody over the head with anything. Yeah. And I think I've been successful, like I said, because I have people on both sides of the political mm-hmm. spectrums who are interested in my book. And really, you know, that makes me happy. Because they're not primarily political books.
Yeah. And yet, it's hard for any author's vision not to come of what life is and what it could be, especially when you're writing about the future.
And you definitely have an opinion. And I don't think you want to, you know, neuter the story.
Right.
But... Right. Certainly. I always look at it this way. People from any part of the political spectrum can agree we need things like roads and electricity, and we should try to educate people. There's a lot to be said without really going into these corners. You know, you can agree on a lot. And by the way, when we solve those things, then we can really start arguing about all the stuff we disagree about.
The little stuff.
Yeah, but civilization, I think a lot of people like civilization and want it to continue.
Yeah.
So that's pretty safe ground.
Yeah. Do you think you'll stay? I don't know if I would. I don't know if you fit a genre. But I guess you could say you're a science fiction author. Is that accurate?
Well, what's funny about that is I've never really thought of it. I always thought of myself as a thriller author. But in most other countries, I'm under science fiction.
Interesting.
And in Germany, for instance, I think I'm science fiction.
Yeah.
So after a certain point, these are just the types of books I want to write.
Yeah.
And so however they categorize them.
Yeah.
That'll
it's
work.
Silly to make it to label you, but do you think that you will continue to write in whatever genre this is, or do you have an idea for something that's completely left field?
Oh, I have ideas for things that are completely left field, but I have a few more books at least that I'd like to write in this genre. This I find is really where my fascination is.
Yeah.
I'm interested in science, I'm interested in technology, and I'm interested in sort of the human experience.
Well, you do it so well, we don't want you to stop.
No, I don't want to stop. So.
And you're probably already working on the next one, I would guess.
Yeah, I am.
And how many years have you been doing this?
See, it was, if you want to know really where it started, back when I was a systems analyst still, I wrote Demon in 2002, between 2002 and 2004, and then took a couple of years to try to get an agent, and then I finally self-published it in 2006, and it finally started to take off in 2007.
Wow, 5 years for that.
Yeah, so I would say to any writer, enjoy the journey, because it might be a while, and bring provisions.
Yeah.
Because you're besieging.
There's a certain similarity between being a writer and an actor. I guess any creative person,
sure.
If you want to pursue your art, you have to feel it, want it, and... be persistent enough to...
Yeah. Basically, if anyone can dissuade you from doing it, you might have a problem.
Yeah.
Because for me, I was going to write books no matter what.
Yeah.
I was just going to do that. So what is that? 2007, late 2007?
Six years for the first.
Yeah.
And then... But then now are you on a clip one every couple of years?
Well, the joke is that you have your whole life to write your first novel and then a year to write your second.
the publisher says, okay, Daniel.
But the good thing was, for Freedom TM, I already knew and had most of that book written.
Right,
because
it was the sequel to Demon.
Yeah.
So I
did two book deals.
Right.
The first one, I had the next book come out in about a year and a couple months. And then a second two book deal that was Kill Decision and this book, Influx.
Oh, so you're done with Dutton?
No, I'm not done with Dutton. Good luck,
to make an announcement now. No. But, no. I mean, you're done with your contract.
We have fulfilled each other's contractual obligations, yes. But we're still talking and moving forward.
You worked
hard. I'm in a respite right now.
You get a break?
Yeah.
What are you going to do with that?
Well, I'm looking at your wife.
Yes.
He gets a break.
Yes, talk to the boss. No. we are going to travel a bit.
Good.
And going to see some people, learn some things. I'm, of course, working on my next book.
Do you pretty much know what it's going to be, or are you thinking of ideas right now?
No, I know exactly what
you
it's
do know what it's
yeah,
going to
be. And
you said
I'm,
that last time, by
no,
the way.
No, that's all right.
It's okay. I mean, and this came out, so I'm not complaining.
Well, it's partly also a factor of the modern world, because if I say I'm going to write a book about a certain thing,
you'll get,
and I'm going to write 150,000 books, you know, there'll be 10 short novellas out by the time I get to it. So I really want to be cagey.
Just ask George Martin how he feels, you know? I mean, imagine... Here's a guy. You can't walk down the street without someone saying, "Where's the next one? I want to see the next Game of Thrones."
But I love that when he threatens, like, "I'm going to kill this character if you don't stop." It's like, "Okay, stop."
Apparently, people are not stopping. That's a threat from George R. R. Martin that you have to take seriously.
He will do it.
I'm not kidding. He will do it.
I'm glad that people are eager for the books. I think the next one, I'll try not to do under deadline. We'll see what happens.
So this was under somewhat of a deadline.
Yeah, and typically the way I make that fit, because putting together a fairly technical and detailed book in a year.
A lot of research on this.
A lot of research. Yeah. And so what I do is I just jettison my social life. And
That's too much to ask.
No, so that's what I'm saying. I'm going to try to take a little more time in the next one.
Yeah.
But I already know exactly what I want to do. But again, the writing process is very rewarding, is all I would say.
I
like doing it. Sometimes it's hell and I complain, but I'm very happy.
Do you go, are you like Stephen King? You go upstairs and you write 10,000 words before breakfast?
No, I think Stephen King writes 10,000 words while he's walking up the steps.
Yes.
I don't know how that guy does it. My God. What is he? Like hundreds of books.
It's crazy. Yeah.
No. One book a year is pretty aggressive for me.
And you write in the morning? What is your do you have a routine?
How do you define morning?
Okay, so you get up at 11.
Like we're talking in the wee hours of the night when the rest of the world is asleep. Yeah, I tend to write very late. Although I will say that I tend to...
You know what's interesting you say? Because your books feel like... And maybe it's because I'm always reading them at 2 a.m. It feels like it's wee hours in the morning for a lot of your
good?
Stuff. No, it is good.
It's like, wow, he was not awake when he did this.
No. I have to think about what that means. But that doesn't surprise me somehow.
Because this feeling of the rest of the world is asleep and that it's a private reflection.
That's right.
Yeah. That's what I enjoy about it. I will say, though, that I tend to write like I used to code, which was I would do it in great big blocks. And maybe those coders are working in very complex algorithms.
Yeah.
You know, once you've got all the variables loaded in your head, there's that time where it takes to reacclimate, and so I'll write 12 hours at a clip.
You've got all the threads. If you stop, you're going to have to get back to that point, so don't stop.
Exactly. Keep going till you crash.
Yeah.
And then come back, and you'll see some parts. And again, rewriting is a very big thing with me. This is what I've told novelists who are starting out. Don't worry about the first chapter. Don't worry about the first sentence, because they will not be there when you're done.
Right.
You know, don't feel any trepidation about it. Just start writing. Because my first chapters never survive.
Yeah.
They never survive, ever.
That's interesting. You talk to young writers. Have you ever thought of teaching and passing along what you've learned?
Well, again, it was the deadline thing. I was always really chugging away working.
But you've got four novels now.
Yeah.
I think that we can safely say this is not a fluke.
No, thank God, no. Yeah, and I'm on a let's put this. I'm on a ledge right now. I'm going to take a brief rest.
Please do.
I'm going to start climbing again.
Please do.
But I am starting to read more for pleasure, which is great.
That's nice.
It's a love. Fiction.
What do you like?
Oh, God. Let's see. What have I been reading lately? I just say this. I'm reading Alain de Botton, of all things. It's nonfiction.
You know who told me about Alain de Botton? John C. Dvorak is a big fan of his.
Have you read Joys and Pleasures and Sorrows of Work?
I bought it.
Beautiful. But what's
it's
it?
On Rothfuss. My bookshelf.
Rothfuss, Name of
Does
the Wind.
Does that count?
Yeah, just read Rothfuss, Name
Isn't
of the
Rothfuss
Wind.
Isn't Rothfuss great?
Have
you not read his stuff, huh?
No, well, this is the thing. I've literally spent the last four years reading a lot of nonfiction. If you want to talk about the inner workings of, the Pentagon, you know, I'm your guy. But it's doing a lot of research on science.
Yeah.
But to read for pleasure now is really great.
Yeah, Patrick's been on this show and is really quite a nice guy.
Doesn't surprise me.
And I think many of the people who love your work love Name of the Wind. And, you know, it was Trey Ratcliffe who turned us on to Name of the Wind. He says, if you don't like this book, I don't like you.
Wow.
And if you don't like Influx, I don't like you. You got to read every one of Daniel's books. We talked about the incredible Game of Thrones books. Roy Dotrice is the narrator of those. And just an amazing... a reader. Do you know him?
That would be out. I don't.
Is it a small? Is it a community of people who do this? Or?
There is. You know. Now that it's digital, I mean, there are people recording audiobooks from all over the country. Yeah. But
Are you from New York? Are you in New York?
I'm in New York. I've been 25 years back east, but originally from Colorado and then California. Okay. So,
but the studios are in New York.
The studios.
And did you do this? You did this for Dutton.
Yep.
And then licensed to Audible. Because Audible does some of their own recording as well in their Newark studios. Yeah,
Facility in New Jersey. And, people
and I have to say, a lot of credit to Dutton and maybe credit to Daniel for pushing them. But sometimes the publisher's audiobooks are not great. And this is really well done.
Happily, I've not had that experience. Dutton has been great, and chose you guys. So it's worked out.
Very nicely done.
Penguin Audio.
Penguin
Audio.
Not right. Dutton, but it's Penguin Audio.
Well, yeah, Dutton. Dutton.
Everybody's owned by one company. Yeah.
Is that what it is?
There's one company in the
That's
world.
Right. Amalgamated
and they own everything.
Industries.
Yep. Penguin owns Dutton, of course. Penguin is the overarching.
So it's Penguin Random House.
Penguin Random House. Dutton, Harper, Brace, Court. what a world. FN Dunn is asking our chat room. This is a portion of the show where we give the chat room a chance to ask questions. And by the way, they've been peppering you with questions all the time, and I've been ignoring them. FN Dunn wonders if you had a hand in choosing Jeff for Damon and on.
No, and here's the funny thing about that. Again, I had great trepidation. It was sort of a box I didn't want to open because I thought it might interfere with my writing process.
Right.
That inner voice in my head. And as it turns out, the inner voice in my head is pretty pushy. So it stuck around.
Didn't have to worry about that.
But more than that, when I listen to the audiobooks that Jeff does, I can be an audience. I can actually...
Yeah, that's nice.
Because when I'm reading... This is the other thing. When I was reading fiction recently, especially when I was under deadline, if I'm reading a thriller, somebody sent me a high-tech thriller to blurb or something, I can't help but look for the scaffolding because it's the profession I'm in.
Yeah.
Like, well, okay, I'm waiting. Well, there it is. There, you know.
Yep.
And so I would tend to read other genres, you know. But it seems like with an audiobook, I can just relax a little more. Maybe that's what you were talking about. It's a different way to receive the story.
Yeah, it really is experiential.
Yeah.
San Jose wants to know, Neal Stephenson famously writes with a fountain pen. Do you use a word processor?
Oh, yeah.
You don't?
I read a lot on a little Ubuntu laptop.
Ubuntu, yeah, really? Yeah, oh, like you Ubuntu. Are a geek.
I like it. I like it because
Open Office?
The thing boosts. Yeah, oh, it's got
or
a
Libre
different name.
Office?
Yeah, it's LibreOffice. It was funny. At one point, I did an update, and that kind of went away, and it was something else.
Right.
But not only do I like to support open source in general, just factually, this is a little netbook that just starts up in like 5 seconds.
Never
crashes.
And
the battery life goes forever.
Yeah.
I ripped another operating system off at the moment I got it, and I won't say which one.
but and I don't suddenly, think we have to think too hard.
I will say this. Suddenly, I had double the battery life.
Wow.
And so I can sit somewhere and just work and work. And the other thing is I've disabled it so I get no internet on it.
Right.
So that I
no
just
distractions.
Have to work.
So that's interesting. So you, once you've done the research, you don't then, maybe I better Wikipedia this word. You start writing and you don't go off and...
No, what I'll do is I'll have a search term. When I get to a point like that and I have to fill it in, I'll keep going. I'm sort of like a rapidly advancing blitzkrieg of an army going into the story. And there's other things I'll come back. So I'll just have a search term that changes from time to time.
Right.
So that I can quickly go back and amass those things that I needed to do research on. But I won't slow myself
down. In nonfiction, when you're writing, you'll put a TK that is a note to self or a note to a researcher or a fact checker.
Yeah, editors sometimes do that.
I don't know what the hell that is, but you check, make sure I'm not crazy.
Yeah,
here.
Make sure this is not BS.
Yeah. I'll come back to this. So that's interesting. So you'll go, I don't know, I'm gonna keep, you don't want to stop that flow.
No, but again, that might change things radically. A lot of times I'll do research that will change the story considerably.
Really?
Yeah, so I will go in a cul-de-sac, you know, sometimes. But again, I try not to worry about those things. I'm pretty ruthless after the fact, taking a machete to my writing, paring it down to its essentials. I think that's probably the best thing you can have as an author is an ability to take a step back and come back with a fresh eye and be rather merciless to yourself because certainly the world will be if you're not.
I think any creative process, that's true. To know, to kill your children is vital to be
able William
to do
Goldman,
that.
Was it?
Yeah. And photographer, same thing. You have to be ruthless.
You do.
That's one of the hardest things
it
to
is.
Do.
It is. But
you
I do think
them.
It's healthy. It's healthy because you're right. You can love this thing that really maybe only you identify with.
Right.
You know, and that's not good.
Da Vinci Wonder says, asks what your ratio, your time ratio of research to writing is.
Initially, well, let's put it this way. Okay, Demon. Wrote Demon. It was all done. Got a 2-book deal. It was really great. I was so excited. So for the first time in my life, I was a professional writer. I was writing for a living. And so I went out to Iowa to do research, right? And I thought, holy crap, this is my job now. I get to wander around.
How fun is that?
There were some inefficiencies in that approach. I did so much research.
Love the research.
I could write 10 opuses based on the research that I did, because research is so much fun.
I get it.
And you probably know this. It's like when you start to research something that interests you, that's not work at all.
Right.
So that actually takes discipline. It's about anywhere from 30 to 40% of the work in a book is pure research.
And it would be more if you weren't careful.
Yeah, and if there wasn't a deadline, it would be more. And you're right, if I just let it go. I do have friends who are continuing years to do research for books, and it's almost like quicksand. It can, you know, it's...
suck you in.
So that's what I'm... about 30 to 40%.
We have a question from 8-Bit Steve for you, Jeff. He wonders how you manage your voices. Do you... I mean, you have to come up with new ones. You don't. Do you repeat sometimes?
Yeah, well, I... yeah, I mean, there's only, you know, so much range that there... I mean, if
well, you
if,
have
if,
a lot of range, though.
Well, thanks. But, you know, from book to book, you may hear similarly toned characters.
Right.
But, yeah, it's, you know, I sit down with the book. I read it through once and take notes with a pen and paper. And then, you know, I record vocal samples, like you alluded to, Jim Dale. And, you know, just so I
maintain. So you will do a reference.
I will. Yeah. Just if, particularly for, I mean, if it's the main characters, I'll play with them while I'm reading the book and you know, get them to where I like them. But it's really the ancillary characters where you need vocal references, because you may get to page 250-something and say, wow, what was I going to do for this?
How do you do that, though? Because I listen to your books, and you always nail that.
He's very consistent.
Super consistent. I was wondering, how do you remember that character sounded exactly like that? Do you go back and listen again? Or?
Sometimes it just sticks, and other times, like I said, I'll keep a vocal reference on, you know, pop out the iPhone and record as I'm studying. And then, you know, again, in the cases where I have a great producer or director like Kevin, you know, they'll keep you on the straight and narrow too. So
I did one audiobook for audible.com. All I remember the producer saying is slow down. Do you have that problem sometimes? You get excited, you start going faster. No, you're professional.
Yeah,
you know,
no, I mean, no, I don't think that's much this, but I'll believe me, there'll be times where, you know, Dan and I were talking about this earlier. Unfortunately, the industry has now taken a turn toward, let's get this done.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much back catalog stuff. So we do now what they call a punch and roll. You know, you'll record, and if something goes awry, you stop, you go back, they set a punch point, and then you just pick it up. But, you know, when you have a really solid director like Kevin working with you, you know, he may stop you and say, you know what, that didn't come out as clear. It's, you know, particularly when you're doing the narration, the exposition stuff, you got to remember that even in pure narration, there's still a point of view to be had. And I think that's kind of sometimes, at least for me, the easiest place to kind of get lost, as opposed to when you're doing a dialogue or a particular character. And
it's not the same as reading to yourself.
No.
Even as a narrator, you're a character. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely.
That's interesting.
Or you're at least infusing it with a point of view.
Right.
If it's a scene among three characters, you have to remember that the narration in between still has its own point of view. Otherwise, it just becomes reportage and it's...
Is it Jeff Gerner, or when you're reading Influx, is it something somebody
I think
else?
The narration tends to just be in my normal tone of voice.
He walked over to the window and opened it. Isn't a character, and it's not Daniel. I mean, it is Daniel's writing.
Right, but if he walked over to a window and opened it because something just happened caught his
there.
Right.
Yeah.
He walked over to the window and opened it.
Very
I mean, it you have to, again, remember that the reportage has a point of view, too. So.
And actually, it makes sense to me, because there's a corollary where when you're writing it, you have a point of view when you're writing
it.
So actually, that's
who is that point of view for you, Daniel? Is it you?
You know... It's definitely the spirit of the reason I'm writing the book. It's almost like the voice of the book, the thrust and that typically ties to theme. And I know some writers, they don't write books about things. You know, I tend to write about ideas. So I would say whatever energy I'm bringing into that idea, that's what that voice
is. That's fascinating. So the point of view of Damon is the narrative stuff is a different person than the narrative stuff in Influx.
Well, I certainly have a different experience, almost perspective on it when I'm writing it, because, I felt very differently.
Yeah.
It's almost like a borders. I'll give you a perfect example. I wrote Demon because I really couldn't not write it. It was just bothering me. It's just a story that I wanted to get out of myself. And then when I wrote it, I thought of it no more. It's like
really?
it was like an exorcism or something.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think of it, but not in the same way.
Yeah,
it didn't bother me in the shower or when I was lying trying to go to sleep. Like, I got to do that. And it kind of just was expiated.
You're avoiding the spooky and mystical terms that writers sometimes use about the book writing itself, where it flows through me. But it sounds to me like you're kind of describing that experience where it doesn't write itself, but it's more kind of automatic than labor would be.
Yeah, and you don't accidentally write a book. You have to really do a lot of work to organize it. So whatever compels you to write, that's really the voice, whatever
that's
that is.
That's really interesting. So I had never thought of that.
Sure.
But it makes sense.
I have a writer friend who said to me once that he writes to stop the voices in his head. It sounds a little more alarming, but it's, close enough.
But that's what the book is. Yeah. That's what the book is. Wow, I just want to spend 10 more hours with you guys. But you and 10 or 11 hours when you read a book of Daniel's, you get to spend 10 or 11 hours in his head.
Sorry about that.
Twice.
That's really... You read it twice?
Well, I read it through to start, and then, of course, we go into the booth and record.
Yeah.
So,
and Demon was 13 hours and 55 minutes.
That was a long one.
Wow.
It was a long one.
It's not a Broadway performance. It's not 8 shows a week.
It's Nicholas Nickleby twice.
Yeah. Right. Holy moly. That's now when you put it that way. Folks, if you haven't read any of Daniel's books, you will read all 4 of them. I know. But you might want to start with the newest, which is, it's not going to hurt you to start and go backwards. Influx is fantastic. It is a new universe. It's not the Demon universe. It's not the Kill Decision universe. Yeah. It's his own book. And it is so good. But to me, you could read it. I had to because I was reading the before it came out. But I think Jeff Gerner's narration brings it to life.
Thank you. Either way,
you got to get to know Varuna through Jeff. That's all I can say. No spoilers. Thank you so much. You guys are just great.
Oh, such
Daniel,
a pleasure.
Thank you for bringing Jeff with you.
Oh, and that was especially fun.
Really,
a pleasure.
Treat. Jeff Gerner.
There's no polar vortex here.
Are you doing a book now? Or are you about to do a book?
No, I just wrapped up. I was just telling Dan about this. There's been versions of the first 3 episodes, episodes 4, 5, and 6 of Star Wars written in Shakespearean verse.
You've done a lot of Star Wars books already.
Yeah.
And you're going to do it in Shakespeare. But see, this is getting back to your training.
They wrote this, and it's brilliant. Forgive me, I don't know the author's name, but he's taken 4, 5, and 6, and we just wrapped up The Empire Striketh Back. And, and it's no joke. I mean, he really, everything is written in verse. It's all iambic pentameter. That's Yoda, though, like Puck is... what is it called?
Well,
trochaic
Yoda
quadrameter.
The same, probably.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's still his voice. It's still his voice, but it's in verse, and it's the exact story. I mean, it's everything that happened, but just with that bent.
Is it a dramatization, or do you read the whole thing? Do you have other actors?
No, this is a multicast recording. Yeah,
and I really enjoy those, by the way. Those are really fun. Yeah.
Fun to do.
Yeah,
and there's songs in it, just like there would be in a Shakespeare play.
I have to check it out.
I just hope someday somebody actually mounts it on stage because it's written as a play. Oh, how good would that be?
That would be awesome.
Yeah, Lincoln Center.
Really a pleasure to meet you, Jeff.
Oh,
thank you so much for being
here. This is great,
and you've been in my head for a long time, so it's nice to meet the voice, the man behind the voice, and of course Daniel Suarez. We're just such fans of your stuff.
Thank you.
I'm so glad you could be here for the new book, and you always hope when you read a great book that the next book will be as great, and the next book will be as great. And rarely do you get. I mean, it's often that you are disappointed, but not in your case. You really shown that you've got it. You've got the right stuff, and I can't wait to read your next one, and the next one, and the next one after that. When's the movie coming out? Are you? I know you mentioned last time you were here.
This one has already been acquired by Fox. I'm not in charge of the timeline for that. But
And it's sad the way the industry works. A lot of books are optioned, fewer made.
But it is a lot of money, that when they do a film. So I can understand the But I don't know.
You don't know. And did they option Demon and Freedom TM?
Yeah, that's still with Paramount right now.
And how about Kill Decision?
Kill Decision. I had a few offers, but I didn't take those offers.
Interesting.
I
just, why not?
It had to do with I don't know. I
okay,
wanted
be politic.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't want to get you in trouble.
They were
anybody.
Individuals who I don't know.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think these are very natural Very visual.
I tend to write cinematically.
Oh, you do.
I don't know whether that's because I was steeped in television, movies, and I read a lot as a kid, but I watched a lot of television.
They're visual. There's a lot of dialogue, so it's a natural for a script. And that's one of the reasons they make such great audiobooks is because they are their visions.
Oh,
you,
yeah.
you see
great
it
happen. Action.
When
great
that
dialogue.
House gets blown up and holy cow. Well, anyway. Enough of that. Thank you, Daniel Suarez. Thank
that was
you,
my pleasure.
Jeff Gerner. Thank you all for joining us. We do Triangulation at our new time now, 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern time, 2100 UTC every Monday. Next week, you just told me, and I already forgot. We got a great one. Karsten. He's got headphones on.
Who?
Ah, okay. This is a great story.
Centipede.
Centipede.
Oh, Centipede. Remember the game?
Yeah. Hell yeah.
An Atari game was one of the first video games written by a woman. The woman who wrote Centipede joins us next week to talk about writing a classic video game, but also what it's like to be a woman, especially in the early days of Silicon
That's
Valley.
That's going to be interesting.
Isn't that fascinating?
I'm going to tune in for that one.
Next week on Triangulation. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.